From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Trump visits Arizona today to tour a factory making N95 masks as the White House pushes back against an internal government report projecting that deaths from the coronavirus could more than double in the next month to around 3,000 a day.
That increase could come if states reopen too soon, which brings us to Texas, where some businesses were allowed to reopen at partial capacity last Friday. And in the days since, officials have reported record numbers of new cases. Joining us now is Samuel King, reporter with KUT in Austin. Samuel, what do health officials think is behind the increase in cases there?
Well, one factor is just simply the state is doing more testing. I know, Jeremy, that people have talked about how Texas is ranked relatively low per capita throughout this outbreak. Those numbers are starting to change and go up. So you are seeing a lot more testing happening all over the state. So that's one factor for this. And health experts say as you sort of open up sections of the economy, you have more of a risk for cases as there's more interpersonal contact. And some of the places that are concerning for health officials are outbreaks and sort of meat packing plants up in the panhandle, nursing homes across the state, and increasing concern about issues inside state prisons.
And which businesses were allowed to reopen last week, and were a lot of people out?
Businesses opened like malls, retail stores, a 25% capacity, those stores that have been closed before with social distancing, dine-in restaurants, limit to six per party, movie theaters can reopen, although a lot didn't, as well as museums and libraries. And in terms of how many people were out, it sort of depended on where you were. Some parts of the state did see crowds, especially going to places like beaches that have reopened and some restaurants. Well, a lot of people are still holding back, just waiting to see what happens. But definitely an increase in activity as opposed to what was there before the state opened up some of those businesses that were allowed to reopen.
And the allowed to reopen part came from the governor of Texas. Are cities across the state on the same page as the governor when it comes to the timeline for reopening?
A lot of the largest cities and counties in the state, their elected officials were waiting for a slower timeline. They were sort of looking at these same steps that the governor had put out, but they felt it might have been a week or two too early. But the governor's order in Texas, at least, does override, supersede, if you will, their orders. And that includes mask orders that were in effect in places like Houston and here in Austin, where there were fines and penalties if you didn't wear a mask in public places. The governor has said there can not be any penalties. But Austin, for instance, recently, and in their new orders, they say they are still calling for masks to be worn, although they can't issue any fines or penalties for it. Just because, Jeremy, their health officials are worried that you get more people out interacting, that's naturally going to lead to an increase in cases.
And just a few seconds here, but the governor is expected to make an announcement today about the state's response to the virus. Do you think he's going to change any of the plans because of the rising cases?
Well, what the big cities are hoping for is maybe giving them some discretion on whether to pull back some of these restrictions. We'll see if that happens. Also, in the second phase of it, they're talk about sort of bars, gyms, barbershops, things like that. We'll see if the governor is going to announce that today as well.
That is Samuel King at KUT in Austin. Thank you.
Thank you.
The battle to stop the spread of the coronavirus is intensifying in Latin America's largest country, Brazil. More than 7,000 people there have been killed by COVID-19. But lags in testing make it impossible to know how many people are truly sick. And as in the U.S., there's the political battle, with the country's far-right president front and center. For more, we bring in NPR South America correspondent Philip Reeves in Rio de Janeiro. And Philip, the death toll is huge. What have you been seeing and hearing?
Yeah, I mean, one newspaper here has calculated that 16 people are dying every hour on average. Mm-hmm. Here in Rio, COVID-related deaths are up by nearly two-thirds in 1 week. It's also very bad in the north and northeast of Brazil. In Manaus, the city of Manaus, in the gigantic state of Amazonas in the Amazon rainforest, they had an average daily rate of 30 deaths and that rocketed up to over 120. And they found that 600% increase in respiratory diseases, which were not being reported as coronavirus related. Yeah. We're beginning to see some restrictions getting tightened. There's a 10-day lockdown in one city in the north. But overall, the picture is very grim, and there's not a sense that it's under control at all.
Well, because you've got the president, Jair Bolsonaro, opposing the social isolation measures, which have been introduced by governors and mayors. He's shaking hands. He's not wearing a mask. How are Brazilians viewing him?
Well, it's a very polarized society, and Jair Bolsonaro is doing this very deliberately, very flamboyantly. He doesn't agree with social isolation. He went to a demonstration on Sunday in the capital, Brasilia. He was in front of a crowd. He's constantly sort of advertising his position, and that may be one of the reasons why the level of compliance with stay-at-home orders is worryingly low, according to the state governors and mayors. In the big city of Sao Paulo, it's hovering around 50%. They say they need 70% for this to be effective.
Yeah, it's so interesting. Here in the States, we have President Trump, who's tweeted out support of protesters, but also issuing federal guidelines. It sounds like in Brazil, you know, Bolsonaro dispenses with any support of any of the guidelines. And then there's the tension between him and the Brazilian courts. What's going on there?
Yeah, he's now at the center of a political crisis, which it took off when he sacked the federal police chief. That prompted his justice minister to quit. Bolsonaro then tried to appoint a family friend, which was widely seen as a move to protect one of his sons from prosecution as the new head of the federal police. That was blocked, and now the Supreme Court's conducting a criminal investigation, and three cabinet ministers are expected to be subpoenaed. Bolsonaro's an army man. You know, he has many military in his government. The military keeps saying it's determined to protect the constitution of Brazil, but he's setting off alarm bells about whether he might constitute an actual threat to democracy. You know, this country did have a military dictatorship. A strong sense of instability is creeping into this political environment.
Mm. NPR South America correspondent Philip Reeves, keeping an eye on Brazil for us there in Rio de Janeiro. Thank you, Phil. We'll stay in touch with you as well.
You're welcome.
Well, here in the U.S., California Governor Gavin Newsom is moving ahead with plans to slowly reopen the state. Yesterday, he announced that some retail businesses will be allowed to reopen as soon as Friday. Still, experts say the roadmap back to normal life could take a year or longer. So what does that mean for political candidates trying to run for office in this era of social distancing? Scott Schaefer of Emberstation KQED in San Francisco has the story.
Seppi Shine announced she was running for the West Hollywood City Council with a video message back in November.
I am running my People Power campaign to represent you and to win a seat on West Hollywood City Council.
There's never been a woman of color on the West Hollywood City Council, and Shine, whose family fled Iran when she was five, is hoping to become the first. In early March, she had a fundraiser at her mom's place in San Jose, California. And that's when she realized everything was about to change.
Some people were scared to come, and the flights got canceled that night. We were supposed to leave after the fundraiser. We ended up having to take a rental car getting home at 4 a.m.
Campaigns have always thrived on people. Volunteers making phone calls and knocking on doors. Candidate meet and greets in living rooms. Handshakes, selfies, rallies. All of it pretty much forbidden right now.
Thank you for being here with us tonight. I'm going to introduce my team for tonight's webinar.
For the past few weeks, dozens of women running for office across the country have tuned into a five-part webinar called Campaigning Through Crisis. It's put on by Emerge America, which trains Democratic women to run for office. The webinar facilitator is Jill Barkley Roy, who unsuccessfully ran for office in Maine.
I can't imagine how overwhelming it is to be a candidate right now. So allowing them to get together in a group setting like this and share advice and tips and just, you know, encouragement is really important.
Beyond the encouragement, though, Roy says, with the political environment so dramatically changed, the candidates need to get back to basics.
And that they remember that the reason that they ran for office in the first place is still true, and that there's probably new reasons now for why they need to continue to campaign, continue to stay in this race and win.
Ashanti Golar, the head of Emerge America, says the idea for Campaigning Through Crisis came from one of their graduates, San Francisco Mayor London Breed.
So when she started implementing social distancing, banning large gatherings, that's when we knew that things were going to change.
That pivot includes recalculating the number of votes a candidate needs to win the race and where those votes will come from.
If you have a lot of college students in your district and all of those college students are gone because campuses are shut down, how are you recalculating your win number?
For Seppi Shine in West Hollywood, that's meant pivoting from asking voters for support to supporting voters.
We started a group called WeHo Neighbors Helping Neighbors. We created a Facebook page and Instagram and Twitter.
Using social media, she now has a small army of volunteers helping potential constituents survive the pandemic, sort of like an elected official would. Shine and other candidates like her hope that being there for their community in a crisis will help them win their election come November. For Here and Now, I'm Scott Schaefer.
And let's head now to the small city of Gallup, New Mexico, a coronavirus hotspot with the third highest rate of infection of any metropolitan city in the U.S., because just northwest of Gallup is the country's largest Native American reservation, the Navajo Nation, with one of the worst outbreaks in the country. Navajo leaders worried that their attempts at restrictions weren't being followed in Gallup, and the mayor of Gallup asked the governor of the state to invoke the Riot Control Act, which allowed the National Guard to close and guard all roads into Gallup. Residents aren't allowed to leave their homes unless it's for an emergency or a critical trip, and if they do, no more than two people to a car. Joining us now, the mayor of Gallup, it's Louis Bonaguidi. And Mr. Mayor, you asked for this. You're very much in favor of this. Why?
Gallup is such a unique community. I mean, as you pointed out, we're the closest to the Navajo Reservation. It's a regional shopping area, so we get an influx of anywhere from 35 to 50,000 people coming into our community. Wow. Our COVID cases in New Mexico, anyway, McKinley County basically is 30% of it. And we thought, well, if we could block off the city, keep those people from coming into the community, possibly it'll slow it down, if anything. But we don't want those people coming into Gallup and then going home and spreading it to their families, too. So,
yeah, it's interesting you say that, because there are people in Gallup and even surrounding cities, in Grants, which is also near the tribal nations in the western part of your state. The mayor there defied your governor's orders last week, telling businesses to reopen. Your Supreme Court there ordered that mayor to, you know, subsequently obey the state orders. But that mayor was saying, no, no, it's the people from the nations that were bringing the illness to us. And you just said you don't want people coming from the reservation, picking it up from people in Gallup and maybe taking it back. What do you say to people, though, who are concerned about the impact on your economy? I mean, pretty strict here, as we said, only essential businesses can stay open. You're going to allow your police to issue misdemeanor citations for first-time violators of some of these restrictions, and repeat offenders could face felony charges in the state. This is tough.
It is. You know, and conferring with health professionals, they're basically saying if we could get this under control in the next 3 or 4 weeks, and then there's a good possibility we'll be able to open up our stores. But if we don't, then chances are this virus could affect us for the whole summer, you know, in which case, like you say, the economy of our community would definitely be hurting if that be the case. The choice between the two was easy, basically. Let's close it off. Let's see if we can break that cycle and get it over with in the next 3 or 4 weeks.
Yeah. Well, you have another thing to deal with. We know there's anger because the Trump administration did not give any of the billions of dollars in coronavirus relief to tribes, that $2.2 trillion stimulus package. You've got a lot of poverty. The rate in Gallup is almost 30%, three times higher than the national average. So, you know, how do you help these people while you're telling them to stay home?
You know, the conversation I had with the governor, and that was one of the first things we brought up. And the governor says, look, we'll bring in the National Guard. We'll bring in 350 tons of food. We also bring in water trucks to make sure that they've got water. And so far, I mean, that's exactly what they're doing. Her promise was accurate.
Yeah. Talk about the Native American population for a second, because 40% of your city's population is Native American. And it's a population that gets hit hard in epidemics. The H1N1 in 2009, and Native Americans died at rates four times higher than all other racial and ethnic groups combined. Similar rates during the 1918 flu pandemic. We have been hearing about, you know, on some reservations, not enough running water, you know, to wash our hands, for instance, all the time. What can we learn about helping these specific people through epidemics? I'm imagining that there's also, you know, families living together, maybe in smaller spaces. What can we learn?
Well, I think one of the things that is evident is that there is a shortage of water, and we're now working with the federal government to put in a pipeline. And then the situation with the virus itself, I mean, we're even closed down a school and turned it into a hospital. Like I say, it's just such a unique area.
Yeah. And but your sense, though, Mr. Mayor, of little Gallup, New Mexico, surrounded by National Guardsmen stopping people from coming into town, must be eerie.
Well, it is. The way we did this took everybody by surprise because we didn't ask to get locked down. We just asked for help. Anyway, after consulting with the governor and her staff, she come back and she said, I suggest that we just lock off the city. And cars were lined up to come into town, but the state police are there to stop them. There's quite a bit of aggravation at that point, but lately that's all that we've heard more praise than we've heard anybody against. We did extend it another 3 days, so it'll be up till Thursday afternoon
that the blockade
will take place, in which case we have to make a determination if we want to extend another 3 days or if we would basically stop at that point.
Well, Louis Bonaguidi, mayor of Gallup, New Mexico, we wish you all of the best. Tough time right now. Thank you so much for talking to us. And again, best of luck with this.
Thank you.
Well, let's turn now to something many people seem to be turning to for comfort. Has isolation got you rummaging around in your freezer looking for those ripened bananas you swore that one day you'd make into bread? You are not alone. According to the Today Show, as the country began to cocoon, the number one searched recipe on Google was banana bread, which makes Here and Now chef Kathy Gunst something of a seer because she was onto bananas before social distancing, back when you'd take food from someone's ungloved hand. Here's Kathy's love letter to bananas.
They're inexpensive, they're good for you, and they have so many possibilities.
Wait till people hear. I mean, these dishes that we have here are pretty astonishing, but you went to a banana museum once?
I did.
Of course you did.
I was lucky enough to be on the Caribbean island of Martinique, and there is the Musée de la Banana, and it's devoted to the history and varieties of the island's most famous fruit. But the thing is that there are over 1,000 varieties of bananas that are grown around the world. And when you walk around, you take a hike through these gardens and you see bananas you never even imagined. Red, dark yellow, gold, orange, from all over the world. The only bananas we ever see in the grocery store are Cavendish.
Yeah, but we got to get to this recipe for pancake.
Yes, I love this.
Is this banana
pancakes? This is like breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So I sauteed banana slices. And again, if you find red bananas in your grocery store or different varieties, experiment with these. But I just sliced a banana, sauteed them in a little butter, and then poured maple syrup on it and let it caramelize. And then it's a buttermilk pancake batter. Mm-hmm. You can make the batter a day or two ahead of time, and you have like this amazing breakfast on a Tuesday morning.
So you sauteed the bananas, which brings out the sugars, which is incredible.
Well, the maple syrup doesn't hurt.
And that doesn't hurt. But could you have just like chopped them up a little bit and just put it in the batter?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. And then you'd have a different kind of banana pancake, but one equally good.
Yeah. Now, I mentioned bring out the sugars.
Yes.
We know that runners are handed bananas for the potassium, for the jump start. But I have friends who are like, bananas may have too much sugar.
Well, a banana is 89 calories. Mm-hmm. It's got a gram of protein. It's got 2 grams of fiber. And it's less than 1 gram of fat.
What's not to like?
Exactly. A lot of potassium and magnesium. And it's an energy food. It's also supposed to aid digestion. The really interesting thing about bananas is that they're one of the only fruits that actually ripens off the vine. They pick them when they're green. And then you go to the grocery store and you see them green and you bring them home and wait. Oh, it's turning yellow. Oh, it's brown. It happens quickly.
Well, but then when it turns brown,
you can make banana bread.
Which I'm holding right here.
Yes.
How great is
so
that?
So you can make a very simple banana bread, or you could add rum and coconut. Also, if you have a lot of bananas that are ripening too quickly, you can throw them in your freezer and make the banana bread when you've got a free afternoon or an extra hour at night.
Well, banana bread is so scrumptious. You have to be careful, though. I mean, we have a colleague who tends to put big hunks of chocolate in the banana.
Yes, there's, you can so do it that way as well.
Banana benefit. But we have savory dishes here as well. What is this?
I experimented quite a bit with using bananas in savory dishes, and they were not all successful. Oh. So I turned to the plantain. Now, a plantain is in the banana family. Mm-hmm. It's green. It's got a much thicker skin. And it's more like a potato than it is like a sweet banana. It's far starchier. It's lower in sugar. And it's cooked like a vegetable. So what I did here was I double fried plantains. I cut them into slices, mm-hmm. fried them in a neutral vegetable oil, let them cool. And then I smashed them with something heavy, a can of beans or a bottle of wine, cool them, and then you double fry them, and they get crispy, almost like a plantain chip, coarse sea salt, and then I made something called a banana ketchup. Now, if you are not Filipino or have a dear friend or go to a Filipino restaurant, you might be thinking, did she say banana ketchup?
She did.
She really did. This combines mashed bananas with ginger, garlic, red onions, turmeric, and a little bit of rum. It is so delicious on a turkey burger. It's great with cheese plates. I would love a little bit on the side of a fried egg.
Oh, yeah. You can taste almost like a vinegary taste.
It's vinegar, all the spices, a lot of fresh ginger, onions.
Wow.
Yeah, and then mashed bananas. And for that one, I used regular old Cavendish, but I also found a red banana. Anytime you see an interesting variety of banana, grab it and try it.
So if you have a banana recipe, obviously we've got quite a few here, and we'll post them at herenow.org. But if you have one, please post it there as well. Kathy Gunst, thank you so much.
Thanks, Robin.
Here Now resident chef Kathy Gunst, back when we used to break banana bread in the studio. I miss that. It's Here and Now.
If you've pulled up to a Wendy's drive-thru recently, you may have noticed one signature item is missing. According to customers in California, Kentucky, and South Carolina, Wendy's is no longer serving burgers at certain locations due to disruptions in the supply chain. For more, let's bring in Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure at member station VPM. Hi, Robin.
Hi, Jeremy.
Well, and no burgers at Wendy's. It says a lot about the effects of supply chain disruptions.
Beef is just increasingly hard to come by in this pandemic. Their meatpacking plants slowing down or shutting lines across North America as these infections surge. So I saw a stat, Jeremy. The CDC last reported that at least 5,000 U.S. workers at more than 115 meatpacking plants have tested positive. So the upshot is you've really seen a slowdown of beef slaughter.
And why Wendy's? Are McDonald's and Burger King next?
Wendy's, we know, it likes to tout its fresh beef. So that's a, you know, just-in-time supply chain issue. McDonald's, we also know, is notoriously powerful. It's proprietary in its supply chain. A lot of its suppliers are terrified of kind of crossing it. So it has many rainy day scenarios. For what it's worth, neither Mickey D's or Burger King has so far reported any disruptions in the supply chain. We have seen Shake Shack report a severe hike in its beef prices. So that could be a leading indicator.
Now, grocery stores are also being affected by supply chain disruptions, and it's not all meat, or it is all meat, rather, not just beef. Giant Eagle, Costco, Kroger, all limiting the number of meat purchases per customer. How are prices being affected?
Wholesale beef prices, they've actually doubled in a month to $410 per 100 pounds. So you're seeing shutdowns at plants operated by all the heavyweights, Conagra, Cargill, Smithfield, JBS.
As we've talked about, Robin, on this show, President Trump has signed an executive order designed to keep meat packing plants open. Some people are worried it's going to force workers to go back and limit companies' liability if they do get sick. Tell us more about what's in that order.
You know, it's more symbolic and kind of bully pulpit suasion. The order declared that meat and poultry in the food supply chain should now fall under Section 101B of the Defense Production Act, which has traditionally applied to, quote, scarce and critical material essential to the national defense, close quote. So this order is extending this Defense Production Act authority to the food supply chain of the Agriculture Secretary. So Secretary Perdue can now take all appropriate actions to ensure America's meat and poultry processors continue operations. In reality, you can still idle and close plants. I mean, you're a private business owner and you have to worry about your customers and your employees.
So you say meat and poultry, because I've noticed when I go to the supermarket, even now, the chicken supplies are not what they used to be.
That's right. You're seeing less availability of the choicest cuts of chicken. If you think boneless, skinless breasts, and you're seeing more of are the dreggy parts of the bird. You know, there are labor shortages across North American poultry suppliers. They're increasingly leaving the bone in and the skin on where they can. But I mean, have you lately seen the drive-through at a Chick-fil-A? It's out of control. It's like Hunger Games.
I have not seen that, but I will say when you talk about the parts of the chicken that people don't like as much. I've been experimenting now. Chicken thighs are actually they're a nice alternative.
Yes, the exactly. Thinking man's person spatchcocks the thigh and uses it in lieu of the breast.
Okay.
Let's Robin not get Farzad. Into organ meat, though. I'm not going to go there.
No, let's not do that. Robin Farzad, host of Full Disclosure. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
You may have heard about people getting antibody tests to see if they've already had coronavirus. Perhaps if they know they've had it, they can go out in public without fear of contracting or spreading it. We don't know that yet. But the more we learn about the virus, the closer we are to getting that answer. So let's bring in virologist Angela Rasmussen at Columbia University. Welcome.
Thank you for having me, Jeremy.
Well, and is the virus that we're seeing today in the United States, let's say, the same as it was in Wuhan a few months ago?
So this is a tricky question to answer, because the answer is no, but that doesn't mean that the virus is inherently different. So coronaviruses are RNA viruses, which means that their genome is more prone to mutation than genomes that have DNA as their genetic material like us. RNA viruses have a higher mutation rate, which means that more changes are made when the virus copies its own genome. So that means that a lot of the viruses that we're seeing have some genetic changes that are different from one another. But that doesn't mean that the virus has acquired new properties as a result of these changes. These are just the normal changes that occur when the virus copies itself. And this is perfectly normal for an RNA virus.
Is it likely that it has gotten weaker over time as it has copied itself and been transmitted from person to person?
I don't think that we have any evidence of that. So certain viruses can, in a given population of people, succumb to what we call selection pressure. So viruses, depending on their hosts, can become more or less pathogenic when they replicate. There's no evidence that that's happening with this particular virus, SARS coronavirus 2.
Scientists sequenced the genome of this virus fairly quickly after the disease emerged. How important was that to the field of virology and figuring out how this coronavirus operates? Or what else can you learn from having the virus's genome?
The genome is absolutely critical to doing a variety of the things that we're doing to try to respond to this pandemic. So having those genome sequences as early as we did, as early as the world effectively did, starting in January, has enabled us to rapidly design vaccines, to evaluate different drugs that may be effective against the virus. So it's incredibly important to have that information. And we're really lucky, actually, that we now live in an age technologically where we can actually get this information so quickly.
Will that information help us figure out exactly where this virus came from? Because as you know, now people as high as the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, and the President of the United States are saying that there's evidence that the virus came from a lab in China, even though neither has shared any of that evidence. A Chinese broadcaster, by the way, called those remarks insane. But is this going to help us figure out where this virus came from exactly?
It may. So what we do know now from analyzing the genetic data is that it's highly unlikely that this virus was engineered or man-made. So we know that the genetic evidence suggests that this virus did emerge naturally. We can't prove that it came from a lab as an accident or a leak of somebody who was working with a naturally occurring bat coronavirus. But that situation is also unlikely, given that every emerging disease that has come out in the last, my entire lifetime, really, has been a naturally emerging virus. So while we can't rule out the lab accident origin theory, it's far less likely than just a natural emergence. If we ever are able to track down the immediate precursor to this virus, we can probably determine that more effectively by looking at the genetic data and comparing that to the SARS coronavirus 2 genomes that we have now.
How long is it going to take us to figure out if having the antibodies for this virus mean that you're immune to it?
So that will probably take a couple more months in terms of just following people who are antibody positive. So we've recently got these tests that allow us to evaluate whether or not a person has antibodies to the virus. We've started doing some tests called neutralization assays that show how those antibodies work. Effectively, neutralization assays measure whether or not those antibodies can block the virus from getting inside a cell and render it non-infectious. It will probably take a few more months of following people who have been infected, who are antibody positive, to make sure that not only can they not be infected again, but they also can't carry the virus and transmit it to other people. The evidence so far shows that it is likely that most people who are infected develop antibodies, and those antibodies are likely in many cases or most cases to be protective.
Protective just like this year or protective forever? I mean, the flu, as you know, each year you have to get a flu shot and it's different.
Right. So the reason we have to get a flu shot each year, though, is not because the antibodies don't persist. It's because those flu strains change and they mutate to evade effectively the antibodies. So the antibodies for last year's flu won't necessarily work against next year's flu. In this case, we have no evidence that this virus is mutating to the point where antibodies would not be able to recognize it. But there is the possibility, based on other coronaviruses that have been studied, that that immunity may wane, meaning your antibody levels may go down or you may not be as protected. The only way to answer that question is really to follow antibody positive people over time and see if they become infected again.
Meanwhile, do you think the coronavirus could someday mutate to evade any vaccine that we end up developing against it?
It's possible. We can't rule it out. But one thing about coronaviruses that is different from most other RNA viruses is that they have a lower mutation rate. So they have a higher mutation rate than organisms such as us that use DNA for our genomes, but they have a lower mutation rate than other RNA viruses. So they are slower to change and adapt in that way.
Mm-hmm. That is Angela Rasmussen, who is an associate research scientist at Columbia University. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Jeremy.
Well, many musicians have taken to performing and teaching online from the safety of their homes during the pandemic, but one musician in Philadelphia has taken to the streets, serenading for hire from the sidewalk outside people's homes. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports.
Dot Levine, who uses the pronoun they, pulls up to the curb and props up a folding sandwich board advertising singing telegrams. The guitar player was hired to play a song outside this house in West Philly. They were asked to play something, quote, sweet and friendly. Levine is happy to accommodate.
I get really weird, specific requests sometimes. Like tomorrow I'm doing a toilet paper commercial jingle into Just Like Heaven by The Cure. Yeah, I did Backstreet Boys song a couple days ago.
For this house, Levine selected Pure Imagination, a song from the movie Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
Come with me, and you'll be in a world of pure imagination.
Levine launched this concept of serenading for hire in mid-March when many people started sheltering at home and avoiding other people. The charge is $75 a song, more if Levine has to learn from scratch, to be sung for anyone you choose from a safe distance.
I thought that people want to connect with one another. This feels like one of the most intimate things you can give to somebody, like a custom song.
Living there, you'll be free.
This song is being sung for Jeff Frankel, who was standing in front of his house with his partner. It was given to him by a friend.
It was the first time I've heard music and since I remember. I've been listening to my headphones, you know, all day, but it's different hearing it in person.
Frankel is working from home. He's a designer and hasn't left his property in weeks.
I had a moment earlier today where I thought about a meeting that needed to happen, and I imagined that meeting happening at my office, and I got really excited for a moment before I realized that I wasn't actually going to get to see people. So, like, I am so desperate that I'd be excited to go to a meeting at work.
Levine is doing about 4 gigs a day, and since they can't play in bars anymore, this is their only means of performing for money. It's also the happiest they've ever been.
It's really amazing. I feel like music is like a condensed humanity, and that's what everybody wants right now, is some humanness, some connection, and music does that.
For Here and Now, I'm Peter Crimmins.
What I'd like to see today is somebody get serenaded by a mariachi band on this Cinco de Mayo. Wouldn't that be fun?
One of Amazon's most high-profile executives has resigned in protest of what he calls a vein of toxicity running through the company culture, a poison he said he would neither drink nor serve. Specifically, he said, it was the firing of whistleblowers, warehouse workers, if they complained about working conditions. Tim Bray was vice president and distinguished engineer at Amazon Web Services. His cannonball of a blog post, as our next guest called it, was published Monday. Casey Newton, Silicon Valley editor at The Verge, is the one who called it a cannonball. Casey, that was so appropriate. Bray quit Friday, the same day thousands of Amazon workers walked off their job in protest. As we're learning about COVID-19 outbreaks at facilities, so elaborate, how big a deal was his post?
I think it is a really big deal. Up until now, we have not seen a lot of solidarity between the white-collar workers at these tech companies and the blue-collar folks who are out there working in the warehouses and actually delivering us the goods that we need to endure these times. But recently, that's changed. And it's been changing at Amazon, where increasingly workers who work on the tech side are emailing, organizing. They've been putting together protests around climate issues. And some of those same networks that were used to protest other issues have been activated to support workers in the warehouses. Mm-hmm. But until now, we haven't seen a high-profile exit over these issues from one of the company's top tech leaders. And with Tim Bray writing that blog post, he signaled that that's changing.
Boy, it is scathing. He also criticized Amazon's philosophy. He wrote, "The big problem isn't the specifics of the COVID-19 response. It's that Amazon treats the humans in the warehouses as fungible units of pick and pack potential. Only that's not just Amazon. It's how 21st century capitalism is done." Ouch.
Yeah. And, you know, I think he raises an important point at every big tech company, in addition to the folks who get the big salaries and all of the perks that we've read about, there are also folks who are cleaning up the offices, who are doing the content moderation, and who are making far less money, and in the case of the COVID-19 era, are putting themselves in real danger every day. And up until shockingly late, Amazon wasn't providing them with personal protective equipment. It wasn't taking steps to sanitize the warehouses. We've now seen multiple warehouses where more than 30 people have been diagnosed with the disease. And so that's what Tim Bray is really trying to call attention to here, right? That this has not been a high priority at Amazon until very, very recently.
Yeah, well, Amazon has been under pressure from several attorneys general who say Amazon isn't doing enough to protect workers during the pandemic. And, you know, Amazon has said to you that they spent more than $800 million on COVID-19 safety measures so far. What else are they saying in response to Bray's resignation?
Well, they're saying that they've made over 150 changes to the warehouses since all of this began, that they are requiring folks to wear masks when they're in the warehouses. And they're also saying, by the way, that they did not retaliate against the workers who they fired for raising these complaints. But again, I think the issue is that they really didn't respond until this became a PR crisis. You know, the New York Times reported that it wasn't until Jeff Bezos visited one of these warehouses for the first time during the COVID-19 pandemic that he noticed that workers weren't wearing masks. So it's that kind of inattention, I think, that's bred these problems.
And by the way, does Bray mention Bezos specifically, or has Bezos spoken about Bray?
No, and Amazon declined to comment on the Bray blog post, which was interesting because when some of these blue-collar workers have spoken out, Amazon has gone out of its way to put out blog posts criticizing them, saying that they weren't observing social distancing protocols. But it is very interesting who of its former workers Amazon is willing to criticize and who it isn't.
Yeah, well, and this is happening as there are COVID-19 outbreaks, as we said, in warehouses, and as Amazon is under a lot of scrutiny from Congress. Last week, the House Judiciary Committee demanded that CEO Jeff Bezos testify about accusations that he misled Congress last year about the company's alleged anti-competitive practices. How does what Bray is saying maybe factor into that?
So I think these issues are honestly pretty different, but I think that if Bezos does go testify before Congress, he's absolutely going to be asked about that blog post. The issue that Congress is exploring, though, is also really interesting. Amazon both sells other people's products and its own products, and some people have said there's something anti-competitive about that. And the issue here is that Amazon told Congress, well, don't worry, we're not using the data from our third-party sellers to inform the kind of products we decide to make. And then the Wall Street Journal reported that no, actually, Amazon is using that data to inform the products that they make. So if they really did lie to Congress over that, they're going to be in a lot more trouble than they are over this blog post.
We'll follow that. But meantime, back to Bray. Just very, very briefly, what happens to him now?
Well, he has apparently already received offers from Google and Huawei and any other number of big tech companies. But he says that for the moment, he is not considering new offers.
Well, and given what he said about the current state of capitalism and these huge companies, I'm not sure they want to let him, you know, into their hen house. Casey Newton, Silicon Valley editor at The Verge. And we'll link you to Tim Bray's post and Casey's writing at herenow.org. Casey, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.